I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Yesterday, Philadelphia lifted the indoor mask mandate for most of the city. Health Commissioner Dr. Cheryl Bettegol made the announcement saying the COVID metrics were at a more manageable level. The city is currently at level one, all clear. The mask requirement for schools could be lifted next week on March 9th, if the downward trend stays. Last month, the city dropped the vaccine mandate for indoor dining. We asked Dr. Bettegol to join us and explain this new policy, and nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Good morning. It's good to be here.
Nice to have you with us. And I want to make sure our listeners can join us as well. You can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times if you live or work in the city. What are the criteria for level one all clear when it comes to things like hospitalizations or positive tests?
So there are four metrics that make up this level, and we need to hit three of them to consider ourselves to be there. So that's averaging less than 100 cases per day, fewer than 50 people in the hospital who are COVID positive, a positivity rate of under 2%, and the last one is a rate of rise that is less than 50% in the previous 10 days. And of course, cases are not currently rising in Philadelphia at all.
Does that mean the virus is an endemic virus here in Philadelphia?
So the concept of a virus being endemic is not one I find that useful. I think we want that to mean, oh, it's fine. And that's not really what endemic means. But it does mean that COVID right now is at a level that it's relatively low. It's low enough that for most people of average risk, we can go about our daily lives and have a sense of normalcy. It also means that people still need to be alert and careful. And unfortunately, that people who are at higher risk, they're immunocompromised, or they live with somebody who is at higher risk, someone who's unvaccinated or someone who has a chronic condition that makes them at higher risk, those folks are still going to have to be careful and may well still want to mask.
I want to pick up on all of that. So as of today, where can you be in Philadelphia and, I guess, legally not wear a mask?
So indoor public spaces, we are no longer requiring masks. However, a business or an institution can still themselves require masking, and we all need to honor that. Healthcare institutions still require masking. Public transportation is still subject to the federal mandate. Any what we call a congregate living facility, meaning a nursing home, a shelter, a prison, a place where people are living together as a group, masking is still required in those places. And then just for another week, as we watch the numbers, until March 9th, schools, daycares, K through 12 schools still have to have masks. We are expecting, if numbers continue in the right direction, that we will roll that back on March 9th.
And what will you be looking for in order to lift the mask mandate for schools in particular?
Basically, just looking to see that there's not a big rebound in cases. So it's not some other set of metrics that we have to meet. But, you know, we're seeing essentially a giant national experiment. We're trying rolling back masks. We believe that between the high rate of vaccination and the large number of people who have had COVID relatively recently, that immunity is quite solid. And so we think this is safe. But we will have a couple of incubation periods because Omicron is so quick to see if that's true. So if cases soar, then no, we won't do it. But if cases stay about where they are now, we would go ahead and roll back the mask mandate.
Do we know the level of immunity in Philadelphia? As you mentioned, the vaccination rate, and then, of course, people who have contracted a coronavirus as well. Do we know what it is?
Well, so we know that more than 81% of adults are fully vaccinated. The number of people who've had a booster is much smaller. And so, you know, although being fully vaccinated protects you somewhat, being boosted protects you more. And then, you know, the number of people who had Omicron, I should say overall, more than 300,000 Philadelphians have had COVID. But because tests were so difficult to get during the height of the Omicron wave, there are probably tens of thousands, possibly even hundreds of thousands of people who got Omicron who we don't know about.
I'm doing the math here. So 300,000, maybe 500,000 people, just, you know, broadly speaking.
You mean who have had COVID at all?
Yes.
Easily, yeah.
Easily.
Because remember, early in the pandemic, too, testing was hard to get. So we probably have quite a few cases that we didn't know about.
What is the city going to do to try to get more people, though, boosted? Because, it's great to have the two vaccinations, but boosting offers additional protection.
Yeah, so we are continuing our work in neighborhoods, especially low-vaccinated neighborhoods. In terms of outreach, we have our teams of outreach workers out there sharing information. We are partnering with Philly Counts, and we actually have a new initiative that we're very excited about through a federal grant to hire community health workers who will be part of Philly Counts, going door to door, having conversations with people, and particularly about boosters, because that's something people have a little bit less information about. But just it's grassroots work at this level. And the other thing we're doing is working with primary care providers to try to get more of them enrolled as vaccine providers, because I think those one-on-one conversations with people and their doctors will help a lot.
Are there parts of the city that just do have a low vaccination rate that you're targeting?
Well, there are parts that have a lower vaccination rate. So we stopped using zip codes a while ago, and we actually use census tracts now because they're more granular. They give us more detailed information. So there are still some neighborhoods that have lower vaccination rates than others, although overall the vaccination rate in Philadelphia is quite high.
Yeah, you said 81%. Here's a question from Erica. What counts as a congregate setting? Nursing homes, of course, which you mentioned, but she also says, what about large apartment buildings, other places of gathering where this should be enforced?
So we don't consider apartment buildings to be congregate settings, but we would consider a shelter to be a congregate setting. It's where people are kind of sharing places where they sleep, they eat together, that kind of a setting.
And you mentioned this earlier, there are people who are immunocompromised. It sounds like you're saying it's really on the individual to take steps to protect themselves when it comes to wearing a mask. Do I have that right?
Well, it's on all of us, right? I mean, we exist in society. We take care of each other, and we've done that really well during the pandemic. The problem is that we can't forever keep all of Philadelphia masked, even though we know that there are some people who may not be able to form antibody to the vaccine. And so, you know, they, of course, can mask and should consider masking. But the people around them also want to take extra care.
And what about young children? As we know, drug companies are working on a safe and effective vaccine. They're not there yet. And I'm thinking about children in pre-K or in Head Start. What protections for them?
So Head Start still has a federal vaccine, a federal mask mandate. So the masking will stay in Head Start, at least for the time being. This is going to be a discussion that daycares are going to be having as we get toward, because schools still are masked, but after March 9th, if we do move to waive the mask requirement, you know, I think that's a good question for program managers at daycares to think about. Should we keep masking in these settings where we have young children? Because, you know, children under two, of course, can't mask. So do you want to keep the staff masked? I think there's a difference between we no longer need a government mandate to do this and what people individually decide is good practice for them.
Do we have the kind of ventilation in schools or daycare centers or other facilities where children and teachers are?
So ventilation, of course, varies by facility. And that's something, again, where the administrators know their buildings and they know what the situation is in those buildings and can make decisions about whether they want to continue requiring masking or not.
Here's a tweet.
We've waited until the case.
No, go ahead. No. Go ahead.
This is the reason that we hung on to our mask requirement as long as we did, because we wanted to wait until the case rate was low enough that the odds are very good that groups of people will not have somebody with COVID that they're going to transmit. But, you know, unless we manage to get rid of this virus entirely, which it does not look like we're going to be able to do, we are going to be living with it. And so we are trying to strike some balance between protecting the people who remain vulnerable and forcing the entire population to mask.
And it sounds like Philadelphia then is like the rest of the state, which is lifting a mask mandate.
Yeah, so Philadelphia has been the only place with a mask mandate for the last while in the state, but and it's protected us. You know, when we've looked at our case rate compared to the surrounding counties, it has been substantially lower because of that mask mandate, as far as we can tell. But I think we've reached a stage now where numbers are low enough that it is at least safer to lift it.
Here's a tweet from Dan who says, it just doesn't make any sense for the entire city except schools to be, quote, unquote, all clear. You mentioned the criteria earlier in the show, and I just wonder if there's something you can say back to Dan to allay whatever fears he might have.
So the decision to wait until the 9th with schools was reached in conversation with the school district. And it gives them a little bit of time to prep, and it gives us a little bit of time before we're putting children all day long into a situation where they would be near other unmasked children. They're, you know, children have to go to school. It's not like deciding to go to the store or not. And, you know, it's more difficult in that situation for a child to mask if no one else around them is masking.
Here's an email from Marisol. With so much home testing, how reliable are your numbers when people might not report that they test positive?
So that's a problem, but it's a good problem. We want people to have access to the tests and to be able to run them quickly if they have a thought, you know, runny nose, sore throat, maybe I should just check. The best thing there is to have that home test available, but it certainly does impact our data. So we are still seeing about 5,000 case tests run per day for which we get results. So that's, you know, not as high as we were at the peak of the Omicron wave, but still a pretty decent sample for the city. I think one of the challenges is with the screening testing kind of potentially not going away entirely, but becoming less, we will over time get fewer and fewer results. But at least so far, people continue to use the various sites that report to us across the city in the thousands every day.
About a minute before we have to say goodbye, we dealt with Delta. We're dealing with Omicron. Do you think there's another variant on the horizon? And should we be prepared to go back to the way things were just a couple of weeks ago?
You know, I think we all have to know, and I think we all kind of realize at this point that, of course, there can be another variant. There are many, many countries around the world where they have very few people vaccinated, and those large populations of unvaccinated people are risky to all of us. So we should be pushing our legislators to make sure vaccine gets all around the world. But we also want to make the most of the times that are good, knowing that, you know, we don't know what's coming. We could have to put those masks back on. But, you know, get outside. It's a beautiful day. Take your mask off. Enjoy it. We hope it lasts. Stay alert just in case it doesn't. And, you know, it's sort of life is like that in general. We never know what's coming at us, really. But we just want to stay alert. But you know, enjoy this period when the virus is at a low ebb.
Indeed. Well, Dr. Cheryl Bedegal, thank you for joining us on Radio Times.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. And she is Philadelphia Health Commissioner. We're going to take a very short break and then talk about long COVID, what we know about it and what it's like to have it. Do stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscowen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. There is some good news about the COVID pandemic as cases and hospitalizations drop off and restrictions and mandates are being lifted with the possibility of a new normal. But for a sizable group of people who are struggling with the long-term effects of contracting the virus, a new normal feels like a faraway fantasy. They're dealing with a condition called long COVID, and the symptoms can be debilitating. Extreme fatigue, brain fog, insomnia, vertigo, to name a few, and oftentimes the depression and anxiety that can come from feeling so sick for so long. Yesterday, Health Secretary Xavier Becerra announced a plan to increase research into long COVID.
If we get the funding from Congress, we will launch new centers of excellence in communities across the country to provide high-quality care to individuals experiencing long COVID and better understand the symptoms they're facing. This is all part of our commitment to be there for Americans who have long-term physical and mental health needs caused by COVID. They know that numbers and statistics alone don't capture the true toll of COVID-19.
Today, what we know so far about long COVID, what it says about the virus, and what it's like to have it. Let me introduce our two guests. Dr. Harlan Krumholtz is a long COVID researcher. He's also the Harold H. Hines Jr. Professor of Medicine at Yale School of Medicine. He is a cardiologist. And Dr. Krumholtz, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Hi, great to be here. Good morning.
Good morning. And also with us and joining us by Skype is Morgan Stevens. She's a freelance journalist, a production assistant for CNN's Erin Burnett Out Front. She's working on a forthcoming book about long COVID. In fact, she spent months dealing with the devastating symptoms of long COVID. And Morgan Stevens, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. And again, I do want to make sure our listeners can join us. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can always call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Morgan, I do want to begin with you. You had COVID in the fall of 2020. First of all, how serious was your case of COVID?
So my initial acute infection of COVID was actually fairly mild. I had what felt like a bad cold, but I did lose my taste and smell. I had, you know, headaches, a low-grade fever for about 2 days, and just a lot of fatigue. It wasn't until about a month later when the more severe symptoms started happening.
And you really had severe symptoms. Describe them for our listeners.
Yeah, so it was about, so I tested positive on November 6th, and for about 2 weeks I had that acute infection, and I actually started to feel better and went back to work. And then it wasn't until about 4 weeks later, a month after I tested positive, I started to develop symptoms almost like a switch flipped. I had brain fog, I had internal tremors, external tremors where my hands would shake, muscle weakness, severe insomnia, constant vertigo, which then kind of spiraled into, you know, hallucinations at one point, slowed speech, inability to communicate or problem solve, a lot of neurological symptoms, as well as the kind of dysautonomia and physical symptoms of you know, the severe fatigue. And then I will say also during that time, I experienced severe depression, severe anxiety, you know, even at times experiencing suicidal ideation, which is something that was completely unfamiliar to me. So it was a really significant change that occurred, and it seemed to get worse as the months went by.
In fact, you said you had overall something like 50 symptoms. You mentioned some of them, and that some of them came on as if a switch was flipped. They came on suddenly?
Yes, some of them came on suddenly. The insomnia, the vertigo, the internal tremors, the brain fog. I remember, you know, I was living with my family at the time. We all got sick together. And I remember my parents were watching a show on Netflix. And I remember not really being able to follow the plot very well, which was something I had never experienced before. And it was very unsettling. So those were immediate, but the more cognitive impairment where I couldn't, you know, I couldn't function in my day-to-day life. I couldn't communicate. The vertigo was relentless, the light and sound sensitivity, and all of those really neurological and neuropsychiatric symptoms, those tended to kind of snowball as time went by.
It's, you know, sounds like an absolutely frightening experience for you. You did go to doctors. You went to emergency rooms. You went to hospitals to get treatment. What were you told? And I guess we should say this is rather sort of early on in the pandemic. But nonetheless, we're talking, I guess, what, 2021?
Yeah. So, you know, initially when I started experiencing the internal tremors and the insomnia, I waited about a week until I went to an ER. And initially, you know, they didn't really know how to respond or treat me. I mean, this was November, the end of November of 2020, when I started having these symptoms, when they just weren't seeing enough people with long COVID come in. I was in a rural part of North Carolina, and the ER doctor basically said, I want you to watch this special on 60 Minutes with Anderson Cooper on long haulers. And of course, being someone who...
You work for CNN, right?
Yeah. And so that was kind of a gut check, because I remember thinking, okay, so I know that we're only going by what the science is saying, and you're supposed to be the science, you're supposed to be the expert and the healthcare professional, and you're telling me to go back to my place of employment to learn about it. And so that kind of started my experience, so to speak, with the challenges of healthcare, with, you know, an unknown illness. I had a healthcare provider say that as a journalist, I knew too much about COVID and long COVID, and I was kind of creating this reality for myself, which was hard to hear, because I knew that these symptoms were not only terrifying and isolating, but they were real. They were physical changes that were happening. And so it only kind of added insult to injury at that time. And my family, who was taking care of me, we were pretty much on our own for a good 3 months. It was hard.
Yes, indeed. And I do want to get Dr. Krumholz to back in on the conversation, but I do want to just finish up with you a little bit more, Morgan. And you have a picture that you wrote an article for CNN back in the summer. And there's a picture of you lying on the sofa, wrapped in a blanket with your head on your mother's lap. And you talk about her coming to stay with you and taking care of you. And my mother had been trying her best to keep me above water, but my illness webbed out, becoming more oppressive as the weeks rolled on. And you talked about her being your partner in pain and essentially being with you in silence while you dealt with the devastating impacts or fallout, I guess, of long COVID.
Yeah, that, and you know, I do want to highlight how this takes its toll on families.
Yeah.
When someone gets sick, as sick as I was, and there were no answers anywhere else, like I said, we only had each other to rely on. And my mother was, you know, I call her my angel, because she really was the one taking care of me morning, noon, and night. I mean, there was a point, frankly, nothing was normal in my household at one point. I had to sleep in my mom's bed because she was so just frightened, terrified for what was happening with me. And she wanted to keep an eye on me because we didn't know if I was having seizures in the middle of the night. And, you know, she would run my bath twice a day. It was one of the only things that would, you know, pass the time, that would provide a little bit of relief, even if it was only for 15 or 20 minutes. She was making phone calls to doctors, to specialists all day. She was preparing food for me. And this is me as a 30-year-old woman, you know, kind of reverting back to my mother having to take care of me in this way. And it was unlike anything I think I will ever experience again. And I thank God for her, because she, my father, and my husband got me through those times. But it does affect families greatly, not only health-wise, but financially as well. I mean, these are things, all these doctor's appointments, they're expensive, even with insurance, you know, and it's definitely a challenge for families who don't have that access.
Well, I'm glad you're feeling better, and I do have many more questions for you, but let me just get our other guest in on the conversation, and I'll quickly reintroduce both of our guests. That's Morgan Stevens. She's a freelance journalist, actually a production assistant on CNN's Aaron Burnett Out Front, and she's working on a book about long COVID, her own experience with long COVID, and the experience of others as well. And Dr. Harlan Krumholz is with us as well. He's a long COVID researcher. There aren't a lot of them in this country. Also, the Harold H. Hines Jr. Professor of Medicine at Yale School of Medicine. He's also a cardiologist. And Dr. Krumholz, I know you're listening to Morgan Stevens' story about her experience with long COVID. Does that sound like other people that you have either talked to or heard about?
Yeah. Morgan, I'm so sorry for everything you've been through. It's just a devastating set of events that throws you off balance, that presents you with so many challenges. And then when you go to the healthcare system, who's very used to pattern recognition, it doesn't fit any pattern they've seen before. And so the healthcare providers, the clinicians, the doctors and nurses, they feel helpless and inadequate. And sometimes that's manifest by a certain dismissiveness, even that they're also feeling that very much they would like to know what this is too, or be able to help, but they're very much challenged to do so. One of the major things is this abyss of ignorance we have about this. And even as Secretary Becerra calls for high quality long COVID centers, and I've been part of discussions with the secretary, I can tell you he's a deeply empathic individual who wants to do something for long COVID. But the problem is we don't even have any guidelines for how to treat people. What testing should we do? We don't have tests. What treatment should we give? We don't have treatments yet. And so people are, in fact, in a position of desperation, especially when they're confronted with what Morgan did. And so we need to accelerate our efforts. The other thing is that people are often feeling alone. People are in this dismissiveness. There's a question, is this real? And as Morgan expresses, I mean, these people who are highly functioning, completely healthy individuals, who've been brought to their knees by this, know that this is not just something they're imagining, but recognize that somehow this is real. I mean, they've run into a brick wall. They know that their lives are different.
Sure.
And so, I've heard a lot about people like this.
Indeed, and I appreciate your comments there. And I want to go back to you, Dr. Krumholz. As you say, we are just in the very beginning of trying to understand why some people get this long COVID, why the symptoms are as they are. There's such a huge cluster of symptoms. Are there any theories that you think help at least us take that first step in understanding what is going on here?
Well, there are a lot of theories that abound. They vary from different parts of the immune system sort of turning on and through friendly fire causing a lot of mischief and damage that ends up manifesting itself as these symptoms. A lot of us think that there are actually not just one long COVID, but there are people who are having very different clusters of symptoms and probably represent different parts of the immune system, or even a residual virus that we never got fully rid of, or activation of other viruses. People talk about Epstein-Barr virus being reactivated. Right. Or it may be that part of the, for example, endocrine system has been perturbed, the neurologic system has been perturbed. What we have right now is that a group of people who are the real experts. I mean, when I consider myself a long COVID researcher, because someone with research skills, I was sort of drawn to help. But the real experts are people like Morgan who have actually gone through this. And what we need to do is shift the paradigm of research and really create a partnership model where we're working hand in hand with people who've been through this, who are urgently in need of help and want us to really investigate rapidly the underlying mechanisms, what's causing this, and then the streak towards diagnostics and therapeutics so they can be helped and the suffering can be mitigated. Because, it's just when you think about, some people think as many as 1 in 3 are at least affected lightly. Fewer are affected as profoundly as Morgan, but the suffering is enormous. And I think the only way forward is for researchers and people being affected to come together. And that's sort of the strategy we're taking and launching to try to see whether or not we can accelerate progress.
Sure. And Morgan, let me go back to you. Do you feel like you're part of a long COVID community talking to other people?
Absolutely. I joined a support group. It's funny because it was someone we actually interviewed on our show before I got sick, and she was an administrator of the support group. So I reached out to her and I was able to join. It's a group called Body Politic. And, you know, they host Zooms where you can, during the pandemic, it was great because, you know, you were protected, right? You could stay inside your home and you could talk to other long haulers and share your experiences. And now, you know, we're seeing that happen on other social media platforms like Twitter, like Facebook. And when there isn't a lot of guidance among clinicians, you know, we turn to each other and we're here for each other. When we have bad days, we say, today is a really bad day. And what was great about that is just, you know, early on, no one could provide any answers for me. And I was able to join a group where people got sick in the first wave. So when I was talking to them, they were already, 6 months in or so. And so they were able to actually, even though they couldn't tell me this is what's going on with you, they could say, listen, I've been where you're at. This is the worst of it. You're in the early days. It will get better. And no one at that time could really provide that except my support group. And being able to log on whenever I wanted to, there was always someone there hosting it, and hearing real human voices on the other side was pivotal in getting through this, you know, roller coaster of health destruction, essentially.
That's a powerful word. Yeah, health destruction. Morgan, we're almost up on a break here. Have you been able to provide that support to other people to say, look, I've been where you have been, and, you know, here's what helped me?
Absolutely. So I've continued to stay in touch with that group and, you know, check in once or twice a week, see how everyone's doing. And it's interesting because there's a lot of new faces popping up lately that have gotten sick from the Omicron variant. And they're coming in, they're it's almost like deja vu because they're coming in frightened, they're coming in scared, they're saying, I feel like I'm going into some type of psychosis, or I feel like I'm going crazy and something's wrong and no one can help me. And now it's my turn to say, listen, I've been where you're at. It's terrifying, but you will get through it. It's going to take time, probably more time than you'd like, but it's something that you will survive. And I'm honored to be able to, you know, provide that role.
Well, let's take that short break and we'll get back to our conversation talking about long COVID with Morgan Stevens. She's a freelance journalist, had long COVID, maybe even still does. And Dr. Harlan Krumholtz, long COVID researcher. Stay with us. Much more after this short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY FM in Philadelphia. While the number of COVID cases has dropped dramatically, some who contracted the virus are struggling with something called long COVID. And the symptoms are things like fatigue and brain fog and insomnia, and in some cases can be debilitating. We're talking about what we know about long COVID so far, what it says about the virus, and what can be done to help people who have contracted it. And again, talking with Morgan Stevens and Dr. Harlan Krumholtz. And you can join us, email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can always call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Dr. Krumholtz, let me go back to you. And obviously, Morgan Stevens was a healthy, you know, young 30-year-old woman when she got long COVID. Do we know who is at risk for contracting this condition?
Yeah, again, our understanding of who's at risk is still evolving. There was a terrific article that came out recently that suggested there might be some markers from the immune system or some characteristics like diabetes that might predispose some people to having long COVID. But honestly, I don't think we know for sure. And we can't say to anyone, gee, you're the one who's at greatest risk for this. What I hope will happen is that ultimately we'll be able to understand better whether there are genetic predispositions, whether the way your immune system is activated, whether some of the other conditions you may have or exposures that you've had in your life may put you at greater risk, and then be able to understand how we might be able to prevent it.
And treat
we
it.
Also,
yeah,
I mean,
no, go ahead.
And I was going to say, and the most important thing I think right now, yeah, is to figure out what can we do to treat it and make sure it doesn't come back in the people for whom it's getting better. And so, you know, there's a lot to learn here. Like I said, what I keep pushing on is this notion that we need rapid cycle research. We need to be able to get out and get large numbers of people involved in research. And then what we're doing at our place is we're going to try to bring together a large number of people, connect people to each other. So I think what Morgan said about peer support is so important. People don't feel alone. They can talk to people who have similar symptoms that they have and be part of research. And what we're going to do is to try to characterize what they're experiencing And then with work with Akiko Iwasaki, who's one of the world-leading immunologists in our group, try to characterize what their immune system is doing, whether there's evidence of viral residual or other viruses being activated, and then be able to match kind of what's going on in the immune system and the virus with what people are experiencing and see whether or not we can see that there are, you know, gives us some clues to what we should be looking at in terms of diagnosis and treatment. And then the other thing we want to do is, with people's permission, if we can de-identify the data, get as many scientists as possible working on the data to try to make discoveries that can push us forward. But until we do that, until we really have some underlying information, then we are left with trying to provide comfort and support. We are cycling through a whole bunch of medications to see whether they help people, but right. Largely it's been hard to tell.
Well, let me read a couple of more comments, and then, Morgan, I'd like to go back to you. Fiona says, my husband caught COVID before vaccines were available, became severely ill, and has never fully recovered. He has brain fog, migraines, hand tremors, fatigue, lung infections. He's asthmatic, also had mono as a teenager. An email from Jane, I have a loved one who contracted COVID-19 in November 2020 and has had many of the terrifying symptoms that Morgan described. She also has a history of clinical depression and, unfortunately, has definitely run into doctors responses saying to her, it's all in your head, and she's struggling to find a practitioner. Just to really underscore the fact that we're at the very beginnings of understanding long COVID, but obviously people are truly suffering from it. And Morgan, if I can go back to you, when would you say you began to feel better, and what was that like?
Yeah, it took about 5 months until I started to really feel like I had crossed over a threshold, really. And a lot of that had to do with getting on the right medication to be able to sleep. Because for at least 2 months, I was sleeping. I was lucky if I was able to sleep 2 hours a night.
Wow.
And that was one of the most brutal symptoms that I had, because as time goes on, if you don't sleep for 2 months, I mean, things change in the brain and the body. And so once I was able to finally see a psychiatrist, it was a 2 month wait to see a psychiatrist. And once I finally did, we discussed everything that I had experienced. And they were able to give me something a little bit stronger that the other medications that I had tried before with my doctors, they weren't helping. And so she gave me something that was effective. And once about a month went by of consistent sleep, I finally noticed that, okay, my body is out of this kind of crisis mode, this kind of where I can't really communicate, I have slowed speech, I can't really think clearly. I started really slow, you know. It was making my own coffee at one point in the morning. That was like an accomplishment. Wow. And then it transitioned to making myself a meal. And then it kind of transitioned to, okay, so lately, I've only been able to walk to the end of my driveway or to the end of the cul-de-sac. And
that's
now
right.
I'm going to walk half a mile and see how I feel. And so I kept kind of doing little small things. And I noticed that as time went on, I was starting to become functional again. I still felt these symptoms. It's not like one day I woke up and I was like, okay, I feel like I'm normal again. That's not really how it played out. I measured it in 3 month cycles, I'd say. Every 3 months I looked at how I felt the 3 months before that. And I noticed differences then as time went on.
So would you say you're, and you know, at some point you contemplated, if not suicide, it certainly crossed your mind, and even thinking that you might die from this condition, not to be overly dramatic here, do you feel like now this is something you can live with?
Absolutely. Yeah. And I want to make sure that when we talk about this, you know, it felt, these thoughts of suicide were not necessarily because I thought that, you know, my life was over. And it was because of the such physical and mental suffering that was day in and day out, relentless, with no respite, with no help. I didn't know if I was going to continue to deteriorate until I couldn't make decisions for myself. It was that serious. And so now, of course, I'm doing much better. My mood has stabilized. I no longer have those thoughts, but there are people, that didn't make it out. And unfortunately, we have seen reports of people who have, died by suicide, unfortunately, heartbreakingly.
Yeah.
And it's really, I think it really shows the urgency and the gravity of this illness and what it can do. Thankfully, I am no longer in that dark place. I'm functional. I'm working again. I still have symptoms. Right now, I still have vertigo. I feel like I'm on a kind of rocking on a boat, but I'm sleeping at night. I'm feeling a lot better. I'm able to work, and I'm really grateful to at least get that far.
Indeed. To you, Dr. Krumholz, one of our listeners wants to know whether long COVID, is that specific to Omicron or Delta, or do we know?
Well, clearly we've seen it across the entire spectrum of the pandemic, so it looks like it's something that can follow any of these variants. The evidence about Omicron is really more developing recently because that really hit us in November, December, and we think about long COVID as being at least 4 weeks of symptoms after the initial infection. So we're just beginning to collect information. There's, I think, something also that's important about this work, which is I think it may have direct applications to a wide range of post-viral syndromes. It may be that long COVID is getting its moment, and it's really important for us to focus on because so many people are infected, and as a result, so many people are suffering. But it's also, there are people who are suffering from probably other types of post-viral syndromes we're hearing about. And so it's an opportunity for us to think about this. I don't think, in other words, the answer, doesn't look like it's specific to Delta or Alpha, or and it does look like it's stretching across. And there are things we're learning that likely will have implications for people who are suffering from other post-viral syndromes, which has probably always been that way, but just maybe not quite like this.
Well, that's interesting because I have two email comments here from two of our listeners, James and Liz, wondering whether there's some kind of association with Lyme disease, feeling as if the symptoms can be similar. And again, I realize, Dr. Krumholz, we're at the very beginning here, but does that seem like it could make sense?
Well, I'm hoping that if we can crack the case on long COVID, that it will open opportunities to understand things like chronic fatigue. Lots of people complaining of things after Lyme. I mean, there are similar features. People with clusters of symptoms that people in the medical field have trouble piecing together, patterns that don't quite fit the way we think about disease, and not really good understanding of underlying mechanism, and being dismissed often by the healthcare system. And my hope is that this work will open lines of understanding that may even go broader than COVID. Because there's certainly a lot of people, as Morgan has described, who are just stopped in their tracks. I read Tim Kaine, as you know, yep, has reported he's had long COVID and is submitting a bill. And I just saw, you know, a quote from him where he says, "I know what my body felt like before. That's not what it feels like now." And, you know, we need to have deep respect for people who are reporting these symptoms and not prematurely conclude that, well, somehow it's in their head. These are people who know that something's different. And in Morgan's case, of course, it's catastrophically different. But we need to work to understand this and then help. We need to figure out how to help.
Indeed. And Morgan, if I can go back to you, and this is something that you've written about, and obviously if people are suffering the way you did or some version of what you had related to long COVID, people can seek out bogus treatments and, you know, flim-flam doctors and people that are offering treatments that have not been tested. And we don't know what the treatment is. Help us understand the kind of desperation people must have and how that could get them into trouble.
Sure. So my reporting has showed that you know, people are very desperate, like you said, and they're willing to travel overseas to go try kind of unproven experimental treatments because they're not getting relief here in the U.S. And with that comes a lot of risk, to their health, financial risk. But also what we're seeing is, you know, there's certain clinics, and I mentioned this in my piece in the Daily Beast, there are certain clinics that are promoting, quote unquote, cures for long COVID. And we know, as researchers, as doctors, as journalists, we know that the data just isn't there yet. And with an already ailing, desperate population, when they see the word cure, or, you know, when they see that this can be very helpful, there was a patient who was promoting his medical regimen on Twitter, and it included ivermectin, which we all know that that hasn't been proven to safely and effectively treat COVID or long COVID. And so with this kind of wild west of what we're seeing with social media, with these clinics that are, you know, promoting these cures, that people are so sick and they're so desperate and they're so kind of at the end of their rope that they're willing to try essentially anything to feel better. And that is, it's a problem, because we should be able to provide in some capacity patients with palliative care that so they don't resort to this and take these risks with their health.
And I'm watching the clock here. We're almost out of time here. And let me go back to you, if I could, Dr. Krumholz, and just toss a quick question from Cadence. It's an important one, but wondering whether young kids are also suffering from long COVID. But then the notion of how to treat, or how to just make people with long COVID, make them feel less alone and more comfortable and perhaps even more hopeful. Can you speak to that?
Well, there certainly are complications that occur in kids. Fortunately, they're very rare, and some of these complications do have a long tail. We haven't seen quite the kinds of manifestations that we're seeing in adults around long COVID, but there are kids who have been severely affected, and so we're trying to do everything we can. That you know, the vaccination, trying to help people, we think that probably helps too. Just at the end, if you don't mind, I just would like to say, if people are interested in the study that we're doing, where we're trying to pull people together, they can just do listenstudy@yale.edu, send us a note, and we're glad to let you know what we're doing and to get you more information if you'd be interested in joining the study. That's Listen Study. And the reason we called it Listen is because we think it's really important that this study be about listening to people and to involving people and including them and learning from them, bringing them on part of the team so that we can all work together. And this body politic that Morgan talked about, there are many of these support groups. They're all great. That one's great. They've also done a lot of good citizen science, a patient-led research group. There's lots of groups that are out there. I urge folks to find out about research. We're going to try to let people know about research also, not just our study, but others. We really want to catalyze a big push towards respecting people as partners and learning together and getting some answers. For people like Morgan, we don't want that kind of suffering. We want to be able to help. So let's all work together.
Indeed. And I appreciate both of you joining us today on Radio Times. Dr. Harlan Krumholz, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. He's a long COVID researcher, professor of medicine at Yale School of Medicine, and we'll put information about that study on our Facebook page. We'll tweet it out as well. Morgan Stevens, I appreciate you joining us on Radio Times. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. She's a freelance journalist, production assistant for CNN's Erin Burnett Out Front, and working on a forthcoming book about long COVID. Go to WHYY.org and look for Radio Times under programs, and you can always download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder and Paige Murray Bessler. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you so much for joining us.